This week on Lunchbox Envy, the ancient Greeks would throw them at women to declare their love.
I gasped.
Okay, sorry.
Terry's used to sell a chocolate one.
And one of Britain's leading experts can't actually eat them because he's severely allergic.
It is apples. Hello and welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Manu and I'm here with my fellow QI elf, Alex.
Hello. Yay. We're also joined by food writer and chef, Rosie.
What's up, everybody? Nice to be here.
So, the apple. I feel like it's so symbolic. It's such a, you know, it's the thing you put on your teacher's desk if you want to impress them.
Well, brown noser. Nerd.
It's, you know, it's supposedly the forbidden fruit. Mm-hmm. I feel like they represent the greatest story of all time.
Oh, of course. Adam and Eve.
I was going to say Desperate Housewives.
Oh,
but fine.
Oh, Snow White.
Yeah.
She had a poison apple. Yeah.
This is actually a thing, since you mentioned Snow White. Have you heard of the arrogant apple?
No.
Ooh.
So this is a trope that in films and TV, that villains tend to eat apples. So if you think about like Draco Malfoy in Harry Potter and Jeffrey Rush in Pirates of the Caribbean.
Right.
And like Colin Farrell in that vampire one when he's a vampire.
I don't remember that one.
It's a thing. So like, I think the biblical connotation, it's also like a sort of quite aggressive, crunchy sound. Mm. They can be acting quite aloof and eating an apple while they're, you know, torturing someone in an evil base or something.
Surely it depends how they eat it, because if there's a villain eating like a sliced apple, that's not I'm not scared of that.
Yeah, that's true. But if you're eating it, I think with a knife is quite evil. People are always like carving it with a knife, and eating it off the knife is quite evil.
Yeah, because you're close to danger. Yeah. You can slice your own tongue off.
Yeah, but I also think they're quite sexual when you take the bite out of the apple.
Yeah, villains can be sexy.
Yeah, you
know? Well, they are. Sexy.
Jeffrey Rush.
Colin
Farrell,
are
you kidding me? Jeffrey, let's chat.
There is the other side to that, though, which is that Apple, the company, purveyor of iPhones, a lot of people want to use their products in their films, but they often have to approve that use, and they have an internal rule that they don't let villains use their products. So they approve the scripts and only let goodies use the phones. So actually, the combination of the two, it's quite a spoiler. If a character in a film is eating an apple
in the first
scene, they're probably evil. But if they're using an Apple iPhone, you know they're not going to be the murderer.
Yeah. Anyone using Microsoft, it's like, oh, this is not going to end well for them.
Adele. Just have no influence on the plot
phone.
At all.
Uh-oh. Don't hide the look at that person.
So should we talk a little bit about what apples are?
Let me guess. They're not what I think.
No, in this one I've got block caps in my notes. They are a fruit.
Yes.
Officially another fruit.
I actually bought a selection from exoticfruits.com. Friend of the pod.
Nice.
Do you want to see?
They are a friend of the pod.
Yes, please.
I still have them in their big box.
Whoa!
There's a real variety of colours here. There's obviously bright green. I'm guessing those are the Granny Smiths. There's those lovely pink lady ones, yellow ones, deep red, purpley one.
Mm-hmm. That looks very Snow Whitey.
Yeah.
Should I put them in this lovely bowl?
Yes.
All right. You know, in film and TV, there'd be someone fluffing these, polishing them up.
Oh. What do they use to fluff apples with?
Oh, it depends. If you want them to look like wet, you might use a bit of glycerin from a spray bottle. You just spray the glycerin on and it sits like perfect little drops on the front.
So like a dewy
it
apple.
It looks dewy.
Yeah.
Or you might just shine them up with a bit of olive oil.
Oh,
just to make them shiny.
How do you get it to, when you want to dunk it in a potion and then the potion comes off in the shape of a skull because it's poison? How do you wax use for that?
That's a special effects department question. I actually don't know. So are these a bushel?
Interestingly, so no, although I did look up what a bushel was because I've never actually thought about it before. And it's a measure of volume. It differs based on the crop. So it's about 35 litres, but it also depends on weight. It's a bit confusing. So a bushel of apples weighs around 20 kilograms, but a bushel of wheat is about 27 kilograms.
Oh.
But then there's the difference between US and UK sizes as well. If you order a bushel, I think you've no idea what you're going to get, really.
But really and truly, none of us should be ordering bushels. None of us need that many apples.
No, it would be far too many. Well, while we're talking about bushels and numbers, do you want to have a guess as to how many apples are produced worldwide every year? I'll give you a clue. It's in the billions.
I'm going to go one per person to like 9 billion.
I'm going to go 200 billion.
Even more than that, about 470 billion.
Whoa.
A year?
Yeah, unbelievable, right? And about half of those come from China. China's a real world leader.
I did read that China was the biggest producer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I calculated that actually if all of those 467 billion apples were one big apple, it would be about 600 meters in diameter, which is about 100 meters taller than all of the tallest skyscrapers in the Big Apple.
Wow. Oh, wow.
Give me really strong James and the Giant Apple.
That's what I thought. Yeah. When was it? Am I misremembering that? Or did the giant peach get stuck on the Empire State Building at the end?
Yeah, I think it did.
Did
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is New York called the Big Apple?
So I read that it's because a Big Apple was used to mean just like generally a good thing, like something that was desirable and like really cool and you aspired to. And then New York was described as like this really happening place. And then people started conflating the two. And someone used it to describe a race course in New York that was really famous. And like kind of the creme de la creme of race courses.
Yeah, it was John J. Fitzgerald, I think, who was like a horse racing journalist.
Mm-hmm. It also makes me think of opportunity. Like, I need to go and make my fortune. I'm going to go to the Big Apple and take a bite. Like,
oh, I love that. Mm. That's really nice.
Well, Dick Whittington could never.
You're definitely the kind of person who would turn up in a city with like a suitcase and a dream.
I read that apples have the largest sequenced genome of any known plant.
Whoa.
57,000 genes.
Wow.
What are genes for?
What? The human genome contains 30,000.
It's the thing that makes us all so different, I guess, is the probably very overly simplistic way of describing it.
Yeah.
But I'm like, all of those genes have just made like a delicious fruit, but I feel like you could have done more stuff. Look at it.
But I think they're all roughly the same.
But they do. If you think about it, we only see a really small proportion of apples that are bred very specifically for us to eat and to cook with. And even the apples you see in the wild locally, like tiny crab apples and stuff like that.
That is
like,
true.
There's a million different ways in which they might turn out. But we really
I think only like a dozen or so of the classic cultivars actually are what you can find in supermarkets.
Okay. So the fruit that we most commonly eat is Malus domestica, the one that we domesticated between 4 and 10,000 years ago. Because apples originally, this never happens where you can say they're from this place. We're pretty sure they're from Kazakhstan.
Go Kazakhstan!
I know!
They should make more of that.
Yeah.
I remember the apple. Yeah. Why are they not called the Big Apple?
I think they're trying to, but still the only thing I knew about Kazakhstan was Borat, and that's not even a real thing. Kazakhstan is the same size of Western Europe all put together, and it has like 130 different ethnicities all in this one country. And yeah, that's where we managed to trace back the history of the apple. So it comes from a wild variety, and then they domesticated it. And now there are like 7,500 different domestic kind of edible varieties of apple, which is huge. But like you said, we only eat a few of those.
Yeah.
I read that as traders and travelers moved along the Silk Road, they carried apples with them as, you know, because they're a great handy portable snack.
And a good weapon.
That's true. And then they obviously eat them on the way and toss the apple cores off the side of the road, just as you might do today. Mm-hmm. And that's what helped spread varieties east and west, was like literally they were chucking the cores away.
Human propagation. I must have propagated a few trees off the M3.
Does anyone eat the core?
No.
Do you?
Sometimes.
It feels like something you might do, no offense.
That's actually that's your vibe. Is that a rude thing to say? You're such a core eater.
Sometimes I'm like, I can't be bothered to throw this away. I know there's not enough cyanide in the pips to kill me, because that is a thing, right? Like apple pips have very
small amounts, but I'm not worried about the cyanide killing me. I just don't like the texture or the taste of the, it just feels like a horrible thing to eat.
But then I was thinking, surely that's another way apples would have been like propagated, is through human poop.
Yes.
No.
Very true.
I would have done it that way.
But then there would be a lot of service station toilets with trees growing out of them. So that's not ideal.
So cyanide in the pips, you say. Is that why there also is the poison connotation?
Oh, that's a good shout. I like that idea.
Potentially.
So on varieties, it's a very trademarked fruit. It's quite weird. There are some public domain ones, as it were, like Granny Smith and Orange Pippin or Golden Delicious, which anyone can grow, but there are loads that have been propagated and bred, and then the name is trademarked, but also the like genetic variety is protected. So only certain companies can grow them, and they're called plant rights, and they usually last for about 20 to 30 years. So for example, the Pink Lady, the Jazz Apple.
And Pink Lady,
is she a real lady? Is she a real lady?
No, But they have a website, a Facebook page, a Twitter account. They have had women dressed up as pink ladies in like London stations. There's an official slogan, so much more than an apple.
Oh, wow.
And
so that's so inaccurate. It's literally just an apple. Like, there's never been anything that's more accurately just an apple than a pink lady.
Yeah. At one point, provided like party packs for kids' birthdays, the Pink Lady Club.
Oh, my God. Apple and party.
There was a song. I would be so sad if that's the theme my parents chose.
So disappointed.
That level of branding and a promotion won them an award from the Chartered Institute of Marketing in 2011.
Well done.
Well, bravo. Because the only other example I could think of where it's, I think, similar is potatoes.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have russet and you have Maris Piper and you have... Wait, I just thought. I don't know. But pomme de terre and poms.
Yes. Well, historically, the word apple actually did describe any round, fleshy fruit. So not just what we call apples today. So peaches were called Persian apples and tomatoes were called love apples. Yeah. And pineapples are called pineapples because they look like pine cones. And then people used to think of them as a type of apple, so pineapple.
Oh, yeah, I read any fruit and a lot of nuts as well. You could describe as apples.
As apples.
They're like apple of paradise as a banana.
Oh.
Yeah.
Confusing.
Much better names. There are so many varieties of apples that have great names all the way back through history. So these are some of my favourites. The Bloody Ploughman.
Ooh,
perfect.
This is a type of Scottish apple that was said to grow from the seeds found in a dead ploughman's pocket after he was shot for stealing apples.
Wow.
So that's got a good, it's got a good legend to it. The Knobby Russet looks like a warty potato. Apparently it's very ugly.
Nice.
The Slack McGirdle.
Come on, that's not real.
It's from Devon, actually. It's supposed to be very good for loosening up your digestive system. Huh. So it slacks your girdle.
Oh, interesting.
A hoary morning.
That sounds like every night of my 20s.
And finally, the hen's turd.
Oh,
small knobbly shape, which amusingly resembles a hen's dropping.
There's another variety that I really liked. It's called the Black Diamond. It's one of the most expensive apples you can buy. So it's at least 15 quid for a single apple.
15? Wow.
Yeah, it's mad. But it is beautiful. So they're grown in Tibet and they're like almost completely jet black on the outside and then really pale on the inside.
Oh my gosh.
And it's because they're exposed to so much UV light at that like really high altitude.
Yeah.
Their skin becomes really, really dark. And they can take up to 8 years to mature, which is crazy long because most apples are only about a year. And apparently they develop this incredible sweetness and amazing crunch and they're black and I really want to try one.
Yeah, where the hell are they? Exotic
fruit? Alex. I need to get a Sharpie and just colour one of them in. That is a villain apple.
Ooh. Yeah.
I want to see like a supervillain that has them imported at a sort of great carbon footprint cost to be actually.
And like a giant mound of black apples sitting on their like giant villain table.
It's very Disney. Yeah.
It's very Disney.
I love it.
Yeah.
One of the classics, Granny Smith. She, unlike the Pink Lady and Maris Piper, she was a real lady.
Ooh.
She was a real granny.
Really?
Yeah. The Granny Smith apple was discovered in Australia in 1868 by a woman called Maria Ann Smith. She was 69. She was a grandmother. She found the seedling growing near her farm in Sydney, and it likely came from a discarded crab apple that she'd been cooking with. So she threw her old apples out, and then it naturally grew a completely different variety, as these trees will do. And it was named Granny Smith after her.
So they're cool. Quite dominant, the Antipodean varieties.
Yeah.
Like, I noticed that because Pink Lady, Gala, Jazz, Granny Smith, all from that side of the world. I always thought that they were all English or British.
To be fair, the Pink Lady was developed by an Englishman in Australia.
Right.
So I'll take
a pom.
Let's break into our first lunchbox, and today that is you, Rosie.
I have brought an old English dessert.
Oh,
I love my British puddings, guys. And this doesn't come more British than this. This is called an apple Charlotte.
Ooh.
And it's a beautiful one. Did you make that?
I made this myself, and I must say I'm very pleased with how it's come out.
It's perfectly formed.
And it's very clever because it's one of the cheapest things you can make. This is a dessert made from apples and bread.
Ooh.
And this is Rick Stein's recipe, a very celebrated British chef. It's his mum's apple charlotte recipe, apparently. So the outside is made of bread.
Oh, it's really crunchy.
It's making a lovely sound.
And the inside is like a cooked down sweetened apple compote. And it's basically kind of clever because the bread is like a cheat pastry. Mm-hmm. We're going to have it with some custard. I often think of Alex's palate as like boarding school.
It is. I'd say that's fair. I finally have a right to reply. So
I was like, I know Alex will appreciate me bringing custard. Should we have a try?
Yes, please. The best thing about doing this podcast is that we sometimes record in the morning and eat dessert nonetheless. Mm. Actually, it's quite breakfasty.
It is quite breakfasty.
It's really lovely.
I would call this a breakfast food. I'll tell you the method. You get a bowl or a pudding basin, something that can be heated in the oven. You grease it up. You cook down a load of apples. I used Bramley apples and Granny Smith apples. There is sugar in there and a little bit of lemon zest. That's it.
I was going to say the lemon zest is really coming through.
Yeah.
So like gluey?
Good. This is good. That's always the word I want. So sugar and lemon zest. You could, of course, add some spices. Cloves, cinnamon, those things would be lovely in this. And then you get your really shit, really cheap white bread. That is shit cheap white bread and it tastes amazing. It's so crunchy. It's so crisp. So you dip the bread in melted butter. Use it to line your basin. So you're kind of squishing it against the sides of the bowl. Fill it with the compote. Put another sealing layer of bread on top. Bake it. Flip it over. Turn it out. It looks like a pastry shell. It's bread. Mm. And that's what you serve with custard.
That's so simple.
It's so simple. It's literally so simple.
The one you made had a really kind of nice... did you quite carefully arrange the bread inside underneath?
I have a Tekkers I like to use where I cut my slices of bread slightly on an angle because I find that they overlap better in the basin when they've been cut on an angle.
Kind of made it like an armadillo shell.
Yeah, kind of like that. But yeah, it's as simple as it gets as a pudding. And it also just screams British to me. Like stewed fruit, stale bread, custard.
Those are our key exports.
Yeah, that's basically the principles of our country.
It's certainly what Rosie and I were raised on.
Yeah, it's wartime chic and it's still going. Interestingly, the French did try and claim this as theirs, obviously. And for once, it fucking wasn't. Sorry, France. It was supposed to have been invented by Marie-Antoine Carême, the very celebrated, famous 19th century chef. But incorrect. The actual first printed version of this recipe is in John Mollard's book, The Art of Cookery Made Easy and Refined, from 1802. And that was when Carême was just a little apprentice. Anyway, Apple Charlotte was probably named after Queen Charlotte, the wife of King George III, the one who was mad, insane, in fact, towards the end of his life. Queen Charlotte and him were married for 57 years. They were one of the longest marriages in British royal history.
No wonder he went mad, am I right?
Jack is here. Yeah.
So good.
Where was I? Oh, basically, Charlotte ended up being the longest serving queen consort. Queen consorts are queens who are married into the royal family, not by blood.
Mm-hmm. Camilla.
Camilla is a queen consort. Got exactly, it. Yeah. They had 15 children.
Oh my God.
13 of whom survived. And I think probably my favourite fact about Queen Charlotte is that she introduced the Christmas tree to Britain.
Oh.
Yeah.
She's someone who should be ordering apples by the bushel if she's got that many children.
It's a lot of
kids. Yeah, she probably had to. Yeah. I actually don't think she ever got to try an apple Charlotte because I think she died in like 1818 and I suspect that it didn't get to her.
No, that's sad. So, okay, cooking apples then. What makes a cooking apple versus an eating apple? Can you explain what the different types of apples are and how you use them?
Then? Yeah. So I would say the first thing to know is that there are three main purposes that apples are bred for. Cooking, eating,
and bobbing.
Juicing. Oh. Juicing for cider.
Cider, of course, yeah.
Nice.
So cooking apples are bred for specific traits, tartness, firmness, and texture. Classic examples that you should all know, a Bramley apple, a Granny Smith, Blenheim orange, Howgate wonder, and a Bountiful. Now, cell walls of apples, all apples, are made of cellulose and hemicellulose, held together by pectin. What does pectin do?
Sticky.
Makes things sticky and starchy and jammy. So when you're making jams...
gluey,
or any
if
kind
you will.
Of like gluey. Yeah. When you're making jams or conserves or, you know, chutneys even, you want something that's high in pectin.
Right.
And lots of fruits are high in pectin. Mm-hmm. Apples is one of them. It's a complex polysaccharide, and that means nothing to me, and I'm sure it means nothing to you.
There's going
to
be one listener going like, woo!
Yeah. I love those complex polysaccharides. And in addition, about 20% of the volume of an apple is composed of air held in the spaces between the cells.
And this is why they float when you're doing bobbing for apples.
Yes, yeah. That's so interesting. These air pockets, like most when heated, expand with steam during cooking and can result in sort of like, you know, various different levels of rupture, collapse and softening. Cooking apples will have less air than eating apples.
Mm.
So eating apples will collapse way more. Sometimes that's what you want. Sometimes that's not a problem. You want something that purees down.
Yeah. Mm.
But a cooking apple will hold its shape better while still maintaining.
It's less volatile in the oven.
It's basically, yes.
And it's interesting, like, if you pick up a Granny Smith versus, I don't know, a Pink Lady, a Granny Smith is definitely heavier and denser.
Feels denser.
Yeah, and definitely that's because feels it's got denser. Less air in.
And there is one other thing that's really important, acid. So more acid in the apple, often there's more acid in cooking apples, means that the flavour holds better when cooked. It doesn't leak out. It converts to more sugar. Mm. So you end up with something that's still quite sweet, still very, like, you know, distinguishably apple. An eating apple might taste a bit weaker, a bit blander, not as nice, but it's much nicer to eat raw because it's less acidic.
Right.
Mm. Are there like tannins or something dry and those really like acidic?
Yeah, and cider apples are very tannic.
Mm.
Again, very Manu to try and eat an apple that's not for eating. You definitely find one on the floor and try and eat it.
I have done that. Yeah. Also because my parents live next to an apple orchard in Somerset and they look beautiful. These are cider apples and they taste flipping disgusting.
Yeah, the tannin content is really important for cider apples because that's what helps with fermentation. Mm-hmm. There are some really common ones like Gala and Fuji. They are used to make cider.
Ah,
they have high tannins.
Cool.
But then there's also very cider-specific varieties. Yarlington Mill, that's definitely a West Country vibe.
Yeah.
Kingston Black and a Fox Whelp.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It's so interesting that in the days when America was being colonized, they grew apples and apple production exploded in those times because they needed them for cider. They didn't actually eat them or cook with them. They turned them into cider because that was healthier to drink than the water they had available to them because they didn't know how to clean the water enough. And so the alcohol would kill off like the microbes and they would have cider for breakfast all day long, like gallons and gallons of it.
You know that in Somerset, one of the ways that they would kickstart cider fermentation in the good old days was to just throw a dead rat in the barrel.
Oh, what?
Is that true? That's an amazing fact.
What are they getting from the dead rat? It's just like bacteria.
That's brilliant.
Delicious bacteria. Hell.
Again, another good brand, Dead Rat Cider. I would buy that. That's great. Yeah.
That's like punky as.
Yeah.
They would do really well. It's time for our second lunchbox, and today that is you, Alex.
This week I have brought apple crumble.
Oh, yay!
Classic.
That crumble. Beautiful browning though on it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Very exciting.
It's lightly burnt, which is...
I love it.
I would say is my trademark.
Is that part of the recipe?
No. So this is just your classic apple crumble. So why don't you dig in? I'll give that to you. Okay.
Thank you.
The apples I made it with come from a very special apple tree.
Tell us more. What apple tree?
So this tree is located in the gardens of a place called Woolsthorpe Manor, which is a house in Lincolnshire. And Woolsthorpe Manor is where a very important person to science and British history was born. And he grew up there. He went to Cambridge University to study. And then in 1665...
Oh, I was about to try and guess who it was, but 1665, I'm not so sure.
Oh. So in 1665, the Great Plague hit and he came back home, like many of us did during COVID. Mm-hmm. He was working from home.
Like many of us did during the plague.
And he was doing a lot of scientific experiments, and this tree inspired him
No way.
So I think you're going to guess now why these apples are significant.
The fucking apples, you know, the ones that, the gravity apples.
The gravity apples, exactly. Woolsthorpe Manor in Lincolnshire, birthplace and home of Isaac Newton. And this tree was in his garden. And there is the I don't know, the story you might have heard is that he was sitting under the tree and mm-hmm. the apple fell on his head and he was like, oh my God, I've just thought of gravity. Mm-hmm. And that is not how it happened. Oh. That's a bit of like an over-dramatization, I think, for kind of kids' books. But what did happen was via like his friend who was his biographer and his family who he told, he himself said that he was, you know, doing a great deal of calculating and thinking and coming up with his theory over a period of months. This tree inspired him. So he saw apples falling from the tree.
And whilst on furlough from COVID.
Whilst on furlough, exactly.
Some of us were more productive than others.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I was gonna say.
And these are apples from the tree. So basically this tree is almost 400 years old, which is really unusually old for an apple tree. They don't usually live that long. It did blow down in a storm in 1816, but it regrew from its own roots. So the dendrochronology confirms that the tree is effectively the same tree. So
don't let those fucking guys who just cut down that other tree.
Oh my God, yeah.
Anywhere near it.
Well, it's very, very well looked after. So Woolsthorpe Manor is now a National Trust property. Mm-hmm. The tree is still like very healthy. It's tested regularly by a specialist, as we all should be.
And still fruiting.
Whoa. It grows great crops every year. They're picked every year and then put in the gift shop and you can take some home in exchange for a donation. So I really love how accessible the apples still are. This is such a special thing, but it's not behind, you know, in a private place behind a load of gates and you mm-hmm. can't go near it. So I got in touch with them and spoke to a lovely lady called Emma. They were harvested last week. And she sent me a box full of apples for me to make this apple crumble out of. And
How much did you donate, Alex?
A huge sum, an undisclosed amount.
Yeah. 19 quid, I heard, per apple.
Yeah, so this tree has become like a global symbol of scientific inspiration. And there are saplings that have been grafted from it, which are all over the world. So there's one at Trinity College, Cambridge, where he studied, MIT, Kew Gardens. In 2010, a bit of the tree was sent into space with astronaut Pierce Sellers. Basically just as a sort of like fuck you to Newton, to be like get your tree floating around where there's no gravity. And the tree was named as one of Time Magazine's top 10 awesome trees.
Whoa. Wait, I was gonna say what were the other ones?
Yeah, good question. I mean, there are quite a lot of those amazing redwoods, and wood from the tree was used for Queen Elizabeth II's Diamond Jubilee coach. They made that partially out of this tree.
Mm. Out of Isaac Newton's tree.
Yeah, it's really woven its way into our culture. It's like a very important part of our history.
Again, because I know we've covered it before, but grafting, what is that process?
Yeah, it's a really, really important part of how we grow apple trees, because if you plant an apple seed naturally, as it were, it won't grow an apple of the same variety. And it's just like if two humans have a child, the child won't be genetically identical to either parent, or it's unbelievably unlikely. And every apple seed is like it's a new individual. So if you planted an apple seed, the odds of it growing the exact same variety as the tree that it came from is 1 in 10 to the power of 17,150.
What?
Which is, that's 10 with 17,150 zeros after it. For context, the number of atoms in the observable universe is only 10 to the 80. So it's astronomically, basically functionally impossible that if you just plant an apple seed, it will grow the same kind of apple.
That is insane.
Yeah. Well, that's because why the genome is so big. This is down to that. Yeah.
No, there's still a tiny chance.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's also a tiny chance with humans, that really tiny chance that, say, the daughter would be an exact identical clone of the mother. So about 5,000 years ago, humans discovered how to graft. And that basically means cutting a branch from a good, in this case, apple tree, and attaching it to the rootstock, the lower down bit of another tree. And so it's essentially a way to clone the trees. All of the ancient apple varieties we came across by chance and then kept them alive, cloned them, expanded them out. I guess the comparison is, if I could cut off your finger and attach it to Manu's thigh, and then that finger grew into a whole new, exactly identical Rosie. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what you're basically doing.
We do that, don't we, for like skin grafts and for organ donation and stuff.
Amazing new science, like they're breaking ground on, where they're like trying to grow whole livers petri dish and stuff.
No, they grow livers and pigs as well.
They did a lot of grazing anatomy episodes where they were growing someone's hand on their thigh, and you know, whether or not it was actual science, I don't know, but I really enjoyed it.
So there are actually three types of grafting, all of which sound kind of kinky. So cleft grafting, T-budding,
Yeah, I've done that before.
And whip and tongue.
Oh, great. Cut that bit out. That I just
Yeah, so grafting has been absolutely crucial to growing apples worldwide on an industrial scale for us to actually eat as a species. And so you now get these enormous orchards, especially in China, where they've created these kind of dwarf varieties of trees, and they're grown on trellises, and they're basically very compact and produce a lot of fruit. Right. And they actually don't live as long as regular trees, but they're designed to, you know, just produce as many apples as possible with as few resources and space. And then I didn't realize also that apples can last quite a long time after you pick them. Mm-hmm. If you put them in cold storage and you take the oxygen out of the room and you pull the temperature down, you can effectively put apples to sleep for months.
Really?
Which means that you can regulate the supply and demand and things.
Because it inhibits, it's like with tomatoes, it inhibits the production of ethylene, which is the ripening hormone.
This is the thing. Our fruit is alive. Our veg is alive.
Everything is alive.
But then slowly dying. We're just controlling
its
death.
You kill it.
And it screams.
So anyway, this apple crumble is it's got a bit of history in it.
Delicious.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you, Isaac.
Gravitationally useful.
My favorite bit of a crumble is where the crumble hits the fruit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the crispy bit. It's the soggy bit.
Mm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That, for me, is the best bit.
I kind of think I like it all, a little bit of everything in my mouth at the same time, though. So, I like, for God's sake, guys.
Okay, it is time for our third and final lunchbox, and that is mine. So, I have brought an apple that is going to break the sound barrier.
Oh, wow.
Ooh, okay.
Do we need like ear defenders or anything?
I'm
going to
stand well back.
Okay. Actually, let's all do it. You guys ready?
Okay.
So, we'll do what?
Break the sound barrier.
Yeah, break the sound barrier.
Oh, okay. Nice. Okay,
so, hold on tight.
What's on my to-do list for today? But sure.
All right. So everyone grab an apple from the selection. Try and make sure it's a firm one if you can.
What are we doing? Taking a bite?
Taking a bite into the mic. 3, 2, 1. Well, that's delicious.
So when are we breaking the sound barrier?
You just did.
I didn't even feel it.
That pop, the crunch of the apple, that really satisfying noise is a tiny, tiny sonic boom.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
It's super cool. So for food to make that audible crunch and pop, like Alex is still making very loudly on the mic, needs to crack at about 300 meters per second. So all of those cells need to break and make sound that quickly. And that is the speed of sound.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And is that true? Sorry, is it just apple specific?
No. So it's any food that makes that incredible pop or crunch is breaking apart that quickly. So there's that faster movement. And that's why you get that incredible, like, pew.
So, like, crisps.
Yes.
Wow.
I know. It's really cool. And we obviously love crunchy foods. Well, most of us love crunchy foods. It's to do with freshness often. So we've kind of evolved to, like, associate that with freshness. Foods that probably aren't going to kill us because they've just come off the tree. In 2014, there were some scientists at the University of Leicester who did some maths to figure out how many people would need to crunch crunchy foods at the same time to knock over a cereal box just with the sound, because that tiny sonic boom is really, really small.
Yeah.
But if you add them all together, it's going to make a force that could knock something over.
And what are the practical applications of that kind of research, Manu?
Well,
I thought it was going to be enough to like knock a meteor away from Earth that's on course for collision. It's just a cereal box.
It was an empty cereal box as well, so not even a full one.
It's kind of making me think of Matilda again.
Yeah.
You know, she does her.
She's trying to knock over the cereal box. That's so true. Yeah. Maybe that's how they did it in the film. Mm. They had thousands and thousands of people eating apples just off camera. Yeah.
So how many people?
Well, it would be slightly more. It'd be 29 million people.
Okay.
All crunchy. When I say a tiny sonic boom, I do mean really tiny.
Yeah.
I was also looking into just like biting power in general, because our jaws are so strong. So our masseters, the muscles in our cheeks, around our molars, we can produce like 90 kilograms of force which is mad. So like our jaws can press harder than
you could stand on. Most people probably don't weigh 90 kilograms. Yeah, you could bite harder than you could jump on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's actually one of the more popular Botox treatments at the moment, masseter Botox.
Oh. What is that?
For some people, it's genuine, like teeth grinding, jaw grinding, migraines. It's really good for preventative things like that. But it basically relaxes your masseter muscle.
Oh.
Also, you get slimmer face here.
Oh.
For some people, and also for other people who maybe have like a really tight jaw, can't open their mouth very far, it means that they can open their mouth properly and like, you know.
Okay.
Anyway, I've been thinking about it, guys. I'm not going to lie.
Are you actually going to get both?
So she can open her mouth more and put more food in.
I don't need it.
It's for work purposes. Like,
I put an invoice through for my master Botox. Just tell QI that it was for the purpose of research for one of the ads.
Wow. So yeah, that's how powerful our jaws are. But then our teeth are incredibly sensitive.
Yes.
So our teeth can detect a grain of sand that's only 10 microns across.
Wow.
Which is very tiny. So the incredible science author Mary Roach has a really good way of imagining how small that is. So she says, if you shrink a Coke can until it was the diameter of a human hair, so tiny, tiny, tiny Coke can, she says the letter O on that Coke can is about 10 microns. So that's what your teeth can detect. So incredible strength in the jaw, incredibly sensitive teeth.
You know what I can detect right now is a tiny bit of apple skin in between my front teeth, which happens every single fucking time I eat an apple. Yeah. And I've just remembered that's why I don't eat apples.
That's why they're not very functional socially as a thing, because I always find that as well. And then I'm like in the tube.
And there's nothing really there. It's obviously so tiny you can't see it, but I can feel something there. And, and it's always the same teeth. It really annoys me.
One of the things that kind of inhibits apple flavor is its own skin. Like the skin of the apple is probably the least pleasurable bit to eat, right?
Ah.
We don't take it off because it's edible and it's got nutrients in it and, you know, it's not that bad.
Yeah, no,
but I don't think anyone's going to sit here and say, my favourite bit's the skin.
You know who would say that? Jack.
I am convinced that apple slices taste better and feel better in the mouth than biting into an apple.
Do you know who made apple slices way more popular?
McDonald's.
This is unbelievable. Yeah. So when they added apple slices as an option instead of fries, I think it's an option instead of fries.
In Happy Meals
for kids. They did this in 2004, and the US consumption of sliced apples tripled over the following decade.
Ooh.
And the same in the UK. Like, they sold loads of it in McDonald's, but it then meant they just came to the forefront of culture a lot more. I guess kids, they had the opportunity to try them, realised they liked them. Then they get served in UK schools a lot more because of this. Like, it's just, it's amazing.
Wow. Like, that one good thing you did, Mackies. Yeah. Well done. Well done.
Manufacturers like apples as an ingredient. They're not too expensive. And
they store easily.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Jack said before, like, we're in an era now where if you walk into a supermarket or a corner shop, there's a lot of smoothies available and a lot of different varieties and flavors. Mm-hmm. But nearly all of them will have apple as an ingredient. And actually, the majority of that smoothie will be apple juice as like filler, because it's a good, cheap way to fill your bottle up. And then there'll be a small amount of more expensive, tasteful fruits that kind of that kind of define the drink.
I think it got coined as apple juicification.
Mm.
Yeah.
The apple juicification of our nation.
It's got to stop. Finally, we got political.
Justice for pets.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox Envy. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox Envy Pod.
That's right. You can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
Rosie, do you have any final apple recipes for us to finish on?
I actually just say, give that apple charlotte a go. Rick Stein's apple charlotte.
Yeah.
Mm. I thought that was absolutely divine.
It was delicious.
I'm going to be making that again all bloody autumn long, because it is so easy and so tasty.
So we'll leave you with this. If you have a particularly prominent Adam's apple, you could describe yourself as cock-throttled.
Ooh.
Oh my god.
Or you could not.
Yeah, maybe don't do that. Okay, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Alex Bell, and me, Manu Oreo. It was mixed by Liang Li and produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.